Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-5196. Empresa Cubana Exportadora de Alimentos y Productos Varios, doing business as Cuba Export Appellant versus United States Department of Treasury, Office of Foreign Assets Control et al. Mr. Bernstein for the appellant, Mr. Levy for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Bernstein with Debevoise in Plimpton, New York. I represent Cuba Export, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may, for rebuttal. Some might think it ironic that we're standing here representing a Cuban company suing the United States, asserting violations of our due process. But regardless of whether my client is a U.S. or a Cuban entity, what's at issue here is whether the United States will respect established property rights. The property at issue in this case is a trademark, intellectual property. The trademark is Havana Club. It was registered by my client in 1976, not because it was selling rum in the United States. Of course, it was barred from doing so under the Cuban embargo. But rather because Cuba Export wanted to preserve its rights in that trademark so that it could use the trademark in the future if the embargo is lifted. And indeed, the Cuban asset control regulations specifically allow Cuban entities to register and maintain their trademarks in the United States for that very reason. That's the same respect, by the way, that the United States expects of other countries like Cuba, where U.S. trademarks are registered and preserved so that they too can be used in the future when the embargo is lifted. Now, a key issue in this case is what is the nature of this trademark right. In the United States, when a trademark is registered, it gives you perpetual rights in that trademark. The trademark comes with the rights to constantly renew it as long as the mark has not been abandoned. And there is a renewal scheme where right now the law is every 10 years, it used to be every 20 years, you file an application with the trademark office to get your trademark renewed. And all you have to do in that application is assert that your mark has not been abandoned, either because you're continuing to use it or because you have an excuse for non-use and the embargo has been found to be an appropriate excuse. And that's exactly what my client wants to do here. Having registered its rights in Havana Club trademark in 1976, having properly renewed it in 1996, in 2006 it went to renew it again. And the key point is that at renewal, it is not the creation of a new right. All you are doing is affirming your continuing right because the mark has not been abandoned. And that leads me to the first error of law in the decision of the district court. The district court treated renewal as if it was the acquisition of, quote, additional property rights. That's in the joint appendix at 267 and 462, the two decisions below. That is not correct as a matter of trademark law. The renewal of a trademark only continues the rights that you have. It does not constitute the creation of some new right. That, indeed, is a decision.
It continues it only if the renewal is accepted.
The renewal does need to be accepted, but
right.
The trademark office.
It's not automatic. It's not automatic. There's no guarantee.
The trademark office has no discretion. As long as you affirm in your renewal application that the rights have not been abandoned, the renewal is automatic at that point. There's no discretion.
How does Section 211 fit in here?
Well, that's the issue. What Section 211 does, of course, is it changes the rights that my client was given in 1976.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. It's not automatic. I mean, you're leaving out the most important question.
But we, of course, why we're here is we think the way Section 211 operates is to retroactively take away that trademark right.
That's assuming, of course, that you read 211 the way the government reads it.
Your Honor, that is absolutely one of the grounds on which I think this decision can be overturned, because our view is that it's inappropriate to read Section 211 retroactively. Our view is that presumption that statutes are not retroactive. And in this case, what Section 211, which was passed in 1998, did was it purported to stop the payment of that fee, a $400 fee at the time, to have your mark renewed, to have your registration renewed. And Section 211 in 1998 reaches back in time and takes away that right that we had from 1976 on. So by being retroactive, if it's read the way the government asserts, we believe that's a violation of the substantive due process rights. Now, you don't have to go there, Judge Silberman.
No, wait a minute. You don't even have to, perhaps you don't even have to go into the constitutional question. As the Second Circuit pointed out, they thought the statute was ambiguous as to whether it was prospective only.
You
mentioned that in your briefs.
That's right. And we think the Second Circuit is right in the Havana Club case when it says that because Section 211 doesn't clearly indicate that it should be applied retroactively, the traditional presumption against retroactive application should apply.
You read it, shall be authorized means shall be authorized in the future.
That's correct.
And the transaction, you read, is a transaction that took place in the past.
Your
argument being the transaction was the general registration, which included the right of renewal.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if the court reads Section 211 only to have prospective application, we don't need to reach the constitutional
question.
That's
the end of the case.
Well, for us, it's the end of any application of Section 211 to our trademark.
Is there anything else left of the case?
That would be the end of this case. There are still disputes.
Well, we don't like to take any more cases at a time. Am I correct?
You are correct.
If you read the statute that way, that's the end of the case for all purposes.
That is the end of this case, Your Honor. And we would have the right to pay our fee, get the mark renewed, and that would be it.
Until the next time you try it.
Well, presumably the court's decision that Section 211 should not apply retroactively, that's not going to change unless Congress changes the law again. And the idea would be
I don't understand. If it's prospective, the next time you came back, it would have effect.
No, Your Honor.
I guess you're operating, and I don't see the law to be as clear as you do on this. You're operating on the assumption that really, once you have the mark, that's the end of it. And it's nothing more than ministerial. No one can question your general license. End of discussion. That's your argument, as I hear it. I don't read the law to say that.
The government
cannot in any way alter that. As they would argue, taking your position, they would argue, of course we can. The general license was never meant to be a guaranteed property right for forever.
Section 211 certainly could apply to a new mark that someone were to come
I'm register. Saying can apply to an existing mark that still needs to be registered. There is nothing that I understand in the law to say that a general license once given must always be given, and that the government has no authority to alter it, taking it prospectively. I don't see where you see that. Merely because it has happened that way in the past doesn't mean that you have an absolute property right, and I can't find it anywhere.
Your Honor, I believe that is actually imbued with the whole idea of registration, and one of the places we can go back and look.
I thought in your brief you relied on a 1913 Standard Oil case from this court.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's the Ewing case, which says that renewal. This is it's the Ewing case. Renewal in no sense confers new rights. So, having registered our rights in 1976,
renewal. What did you just say?
Renewal of a trademark registration in no sense confers new rights. This is 42 App DC at page 324. And it's a 95-year-old case, and the government takes us to task for citing a century-old case. But it relies on common law of trademarks, which is the same as the trademark law then, and it's the same as trademark law today, that when a trademark is registered, your rights are perpetual as long as you don't abandon them. And the registration to
Congress can never change that.
I don't see Ewing addressing that. I don't see the issue that I'm raising. Congress can't change that. I don't get that. I don't see where you see that. I understand your retroactivity argument. I don't know whether I buy it or not, but I understand it. I don't understand your prospectivity argument.
Because the Trademark Office has no discretion with respect to granting the renewal of the registration certificate. The trademark actually exists
separate. Where is it in the Constitution that says Congress can't change that going forward?
What it is effectively doing is what Congress has done with Section 211. It has reached back in time, taken our 1976 trademark registration, and invalidated it, based, by the way, on events that occurred back in 1960. it's attaching a new consequence to those old 1960 events. And so the impact of
wait
saying...
Minute, wait a minute, just to keep precise, now you're switching and reading 211 as the government were reading it.
Well,
you have to keep straight, because your view is 211 doesn't mean what the government says it is. But now you're, in response to Judge Edward, you're saying, assuming the government, the 211 means what the government says it is, then you have the retroactivity problem.
So if
is that 211 means nothing.
If what 211 means, and I completely agree, if 211 is a prospective statute only, which is of course what our position is, and we think the court should rule on that, what it means is that any new registration filed by an entity, tomorrow a Cuban entity could come and apply for a new registration. And if that registration, if that mark is the same as a mark that was used in conjunction with confiscated assets, 211 absolutely would prospectively bar the registration of that mark.
And I don't see how that line of thinking wouldn't apply to you the next time you registered using your theory of the case.
Your Honor, because we don't need to register our mark again. Once our mark was registered in 1976,
renewed.
The renewal, it's based on this fundamental premise of trademark law, that the renewal isn't creation of a new...
change that?
If Congress changed that, if Congress took away our right to renew our mark, that, I believe, would violate substantive due process.
Well, there really is no such thing as renewal. Congress has no constitutional authority to change that concept, and I don't get it.
We do believe that Congress cannot go back in time and take away our trademark rights that existed for 30 years and say, we're going to create this new license requirement, and if you fail to, excuse me, there's new renewal requirement, and by failing
yeah,
to...
Yeah, the new license requirement.
Well, it's not.
But
I misspoke.
That's exactly what it is, the new license requirement.
The general license that was granted to your client included renewal, did it not?
The general license, it wasn't granted to our client, it's just generally available
excuse me,
to
granted
all...
to the world.
That's
it
correct.
Includes, it includes renewal as
does
part of the general license.
That's correct.
So when that was done, that it was assumed, I gather, that renewal was automatic.
That as long as you make the required statement that you haven't abandoned your rights, renewal is automatic.
And your reading of 211 that you agree with Judge Silberman on, wouldn't that mean that 211 Congress completely misfired in what it was attempting to do?
Right.
Well, it's very curious to know what Congress was attempting to do.
Certainly well, the way you describe it in your brief, it was direct response to Bacardi and attempting to do what you described in the brief. There.
That's correct.
And
as
take away the right that existed, you say, from 1976. Obviously, we'll go by the language, but in terms of the context, it was clearly intended to apply to the 1976 to you.
It was intended by Bacardi to have that effect, for sure.
Yeah.
But whether that was the intent of Congress is very hard to know. The intent of Congress we read in the statute. Sometimes we look at legislative history. There's none here. It was slipped in at conference in a massive unrelated appropriations bill. It was not even noticed for weeks after. Now, it was voted on by Congress and signed by the President. It is the law for sure. However, in interpreting what it means, to ascribe the intent of Bacardi, which wanted to insert this little submarine law into the appropriations bill, to ascribe that intent to Congress when there were no hearings, there was no public scrutiny. Most congressmen probably didn't know.
That can't be a guide for our thinking about the meaning of legislation. The sneak-in rule? There's no such rule. That can't possibly be your argument. You don't really want to attribute true meaning to the language, Your Honor, because we know they sneaked it in.
No, it's quite the opposite. What I'm saying
is... They didn't sneak it in. It doesn't matter. We have to look at the language.
Your Honor, what I'm saying is the opposite. What I'm saying is you should only look at the language, and you should not ascribe Bacardi's intent. If Congress misfired by failing with the language to make it properly retroactive, if you want to make a statute retroactive, this Court has seen many tax cases where Congress says, this is the change, and it's retroactive to January 1st of this year. You say it clearly. If you read the statute on its face, this statute on its face does not say clearly it was intended to be retroactive. That's why we say it should have only
really?
Prospective.
I don't know how else you could read it otherwise.
It, If the statute...
It's so obviously retroactive in its impact. I mean, that's the one part that seemed pretty straightforward.
It's retroactive in the sense that it's talking about what should the effects of the confiscation of property in 1960 be.
Right.
But it's not, it doesn't say on its face that it's retroactive to existing trademark rights. Section 211 can be read, as Judge Silberman suggests, to affect only prospective registrations, new trademarks that people try to register. It could reflect Congress's appropriation, condemnation of the confiscation by saying, we're not going to allow any new trademarks to be registered that were the same as marks that were used in connection
Counsel,
with confiscated property.
There's a distinction the Supreme Court has made between primary retroactivity and secondary retroactivity, right? Isn't that what we're talking about here?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I know which case you're thinking of.
Well, there's actually several. Justice Scalia made that clear in Bowen case, you recall. And I take it to be your argument that reading the statutes prospectively, it has a secondary retroactivity effect. That is to say, it applies for a new registration and it treats, it goes back in time at the moment of a new registration to look at the transaction back in 1960. That's called secondary retroactivity, and that is not a problem. Generally in the law. Primary retroactivity, as a Bowen, is disfavored, and there's almost a presumption against it. That's
Kennedy's
opinion. Right.
And that's because the consequence of Section 211 being applied the way the government wants to is to deny a trademark registration. Prospectively, if someone has a new registration, that's fine. But the way it's being applied in this case is to take away a 30-year-old law, and that's that primary retroactivity.
Can you give me what do you think is your best authority for the proposition that once you've registered, you have a right forever? Renewal is just a given. It's about nothing in particular unless you just abandon.
Your Honor, I think that Ewing itself is
you
one
think
of...
Ewing,
I think Ewing does that. I think Bose and the
That's
Federal...
That's it? Just Ewing?
Qualitex says the trademark... Jacobson versus Qualitex in the Supreme Court says trademark rights are perpetual. In re Bose in the Federal Circuit recently makes the same point. A number of these cases are cited in our brief. With a trademark, what's unusual about this case is that trademark registrations... The certificate itself generally is less important because we are a common law country when it comes to trademarks. When you're using a trademark in commerce, that is actually giving you your trademark right. The certificate gives you some benefits. It gives you, for example, the right to sue for counterfeiting. The certificate is prima facie evidence of the validity of the mark and ownership of the mark. But even without a trademark registration, your trademark rights exist through your use. What's unusual about this case is that obviously we're unable to use our trademark because of the embargo. However, the law recognizes that will allow you to reserve your rights through a registration. And the same concept occurs with foreign registrations that are registered under Section 44 of the Trademark Act.
Before you stop, may I ask a question concerning the process? If one gets to the due process issue, or even the 558C issue, what facts do you contest?
We contest whether there was a confiscation because one question is, was there any value in the distillery when it was confiscated by...
Because of the insolvency argument?
The insolvency.
That's a factual question. That's a legal argument, isn't it? Let's assume arguendo it was insolvent. Why does one conclude if the company was insolvent, therefore, one of its assets was valueless?
That would be...
Even if it was insolvent, even if you go into bankruptcy, then the bankruptcy trustee has assets to allocate, according to bankruptcy law in Cuba, with respect to the creditors. So I don't get that at all, that it's not a confiscation if the company is insolvent. If you take a piece of property from the company that is valuable, that's a confiscation.
It is a question of fact, though, as to...
No, it isn't. It's a question of law. You're arguing that when there's an insolvency, that cannot be a confiscation.
No, we're not, Your Honor. What we're arguing is that if there's a insolvency And it's determined that there was nothing of value taken. That's a question of fact. And the U.S. Foreign Claims
Committee... But your theory is it's only because of an insolvency that nothing of value was taken. And that doesn't make any sense.
No, we would need to go further. We would need to show that nothing of value was taken, which is something U.S. Foreign Claims Commission looks at.
Then you're saying the trademark had no value.
Well, the trademark is very different. I want to be clear about this. The trademark that we're litigating here was never confiscated or seized.
Okay, what is it then you claim had no value?
The property in Cuba, the distillery, the business in Cuba was seized by the Castro regime, but the U.S. trademark could never be seized by the Cubans.
Okay, so let me go off. You're right, I misstated that. So you have bottling, you have another number of assets.
Exactly.
Whether or not the company is insolvent is unrelated to the question of whether there's confiscation.
Well, because
it has assets. If the government comes in and seizes assets from an insolvent company, they're in effect seizing assets from the creditor.
Well, it has assets and liabilities, and there's a question of fact as to whether the property that was seized had any value such that compensation was due. Another question of fact.
No, that's not the relevant. Anyway, that's strictly a question.
Right. It's
of law.
Only if we get to the procedural issues, which
no,
we don't
no,
need
right.
to.
But that's only a question of law, not a question of fact. Now, what other kind of questions of fact do you claim you have a right to?
Another question of fact is that OFAC assumed that Bacardi is the successor to JAS's interests. And there has been no appropriate showing, and we believe a factual record, if we ever were to get to the procedural due process issues, a factual record would need to be built to show that Bacardi, having not consented, because OFAC relies on Bacardi's non-consent, that Bacardi is the proper party that's the successor to these assets. And again, I would really note that the U.S. trademark, the U.S. trademark existed after the Cuban Revolution. The Arachabella family, JASA, continued to own that trademark. They could have paid this money themselves, $25 in 1973, and renewed their mark. They could still own it today. They chose voluntarily to abandon their trademark registration. They chose voluntarily to give up their U.S. asset.
What does that have to do with the price of tea?
Well, because there's an implication with the Bacardi and JASA story here that what's been seized is these rights in the U.S. And my point is just to note that...
You pointed that out, that's not... I think that's really an irrelevancy.
It certainly doesn't go to our argument on how Section 211 should be read only prospectively, in which case we wouldn't have to reach these constitutional issues.
Can I ask you another procedural question? You argue that the July 28th OFAC determination on the general license came out of nowhere, essentially.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But why isn't the case that the April 6th letter put you on notice that you had to make all your arguments for why you had a specific or general license right? And then you argued the general license point in the June 14th letter to USPTO, which was, I think, copied to OFAC. So you certainly were aware that you could make an argument based on the general license.
We absolutely knew that we could have sought guidance from OFAC on whether or not it thought the general license would apply, but our view was we didn't need to. We believe the general license did apply, which is why we argued
but
that.
You didn't decide not to say that?
Yeah, right. That's
because it was the expedient thing to do is just to get the specific license rather than
why isn't the expedient thing to do to say this is so obviously covered by the general license, but in any event, in the alternative, we also want the
if I could retroactively go back in time and rewrite that letter, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. But I think the procedural
After July 28th, you could have come in right and said, after you get the letter on July 28th, you could have gone back to the agency and said, you haven't properly considered the general license.
Actually,
point.
No, we're in a very difficult position on July 28th because they waited till the day after
the day
our
after.
Mark. Expired.
Yeah.
So to go back and try to get more process would mean that our mark would actually have been expired and we would get no process because we couldn't fix it. At that point, we had no choice but to very quickly come running in.
Okay, why don't we hear from the Department of Justice?
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Jonathan Levy with the United States Department of Justice, representing the federal defendants today. With me at counsel table is Douglas Letter, Appellate Litigation Counsel, also at the Department of Justice. I would like to begin by addressing what appears to be the central fallacy of Cuba Export's argument, which is this idea that the right they received in 1976 with respect to this trademark registration was in some way perpetual. They rely principally for that proposition on the Ewing case from, I believe it is, 1914. That's a statutory interpretation case, and it was interpreting an older version of the trademark statute.
You make two points in your brief, the first of which is it's an old case. I hadn't ever heard that argument presented before, that a case is unreliable if it's old. But put that aside. The second is that the statute has changed.
Yes.
In what way is the statute change relevant to the reasoning of the Ewing Standard Oil case?
Well, I don't have the language.
That was not noted in the brief. There was no suggestion that the change in the statute was relevant. It just changed, and it was a 90-year-old case. I love 90-year-old cases. Marbury versus Madison is a very old case.
Fair enough, Your Honor. The key point is that it's a statutory interpretation case. It was interpreting the statute that was before it, and the statute that is active now and was active in 1976 does not speak in terms of perpetual rights.
What are you talking about? What is the change in the statute that's relevant? Ewing, they referred back to the common law, as a matter of fact, as taken up by the trademark statute. Why, in what way has the new codification of the trademark law changed that?
The current codification of the trademark law does not rely on common law for the duration of the trademark rights that are at issue in this case. I'm quoting from 15 U.S. Code 1058, it says, quote, each registration shall remain in force for 10 years, unquote. Now, The version that was in effect in 1976 said 20 years, but it was a fixed term of 20 years. What was acquired by Cuba Export.
What was 1913?
I don't know the answer to that.
I think it was a term, wasn't it?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that.
So you're willing to rest on just the proposition it's an old case?
No, I'm willing to rest on the proposition that the language of the statute is clear.
Wait.
Which?
In answer to Judge Silverman, how has the relevant language of the statute changed?
I don't know what the relevant language was in 1913.
Well, how can you make that argument without knowing the answer to it?
Well, I believe
that you knew we were going to raise.
Your Honor.
How can you make an argument that the statute is different and then not be able to tell us how so?
Well, I apologize for not being able to do that, Your Honor, but I believe
that you still want to make the argument that the statute's different, but you don't know how so?
Well, let me, in light of your question, shift to the argument that the statute is clear. The statute has a fixed term, and it is not a perpetual right.
Which statute?
The statute that is in effect today and the statute that was in effect in 1976. Let me take a step back. The property right that we're talking about here is a creation of statute. It is not a creation of common law. The federal trademark registration.
Well, it was in 1913. It was a statute, and it was
yes.
A statute that had a fixed term and it required renewal, didn't it?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Right.
I just don't know the answer to that question. The statute that was.
Certainly, it wouldn't change the reasoning of the case if the term of the renewal changed, would it?
I'm not sure I understand that question. Oh, if the requirements for renewal changed, it would.
No, if the term for renewal changed.
No, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mere change in the term. And in fact, the term has changed from 20 years to 10.
Right.
That's correct. But I don't think if you look at the statutory language that was in effect in 1976, which is when Cuba Export claims to have obtained its perpetual rights, I don't think you can look at that statutory language and say that it conferred perpetual rights.
But that argument is essentially asking us to reject Ewing.
Only to the extent that the language is the same and that the statutory language was the same in Ewing. And my understanding is that there were changes, but again, I apologize, I cannot quote to you the exact
changes. That's not a supportable assertion.
If that's not a supportable assertion.
Yeah, and you're not backing it up anywhere, which is a shock to me because it's
your
argument.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Well, it's your argument. If you don't have, maybe it's because you don't have anything.
Your Honor,
but
we
it's
cannot.
It's your argument, and if you can't support it, then it seems to me you're asking us, a panel, which we can't do, to reject established precedent.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to submit supplemental information about the status of the statute in 1913 versus today, and I think that would presumably clarify this issue. There are other ways
my
in which the right...
That is, it's a little late.
Yeah, well, I apologize, Your Honor.
My thoughts were the same.
I apologize to you as well, Your Honor. But let me put that aside for the moment and point out some other ways in which this is not a perpetual right. Again, the phrase in Ewing, I'm not at all sure that that was the a holding in Ewing that the right is perpetual, at least in this sense. And it is not the renewals are not automatic, which is another claim.
Your point was that Congress can always change this anyway.
Well, absolutely.
Right?
If they were
perpetual in a statute, that's nice, but Congress can come in later and say, no, it isn't. And the question then is the constitutional issue.
Is it prospective or retroactive?
Right. Well, first, how to read the statute, right. And then if the statute does apply and change the law that had previously applied, the question is whether it's constitutional. I thought that was your primary argument in response to some of these questions.
Well, we have both arguments. I mean, the first argument is that
not really perpetual, but even if the statute were considered perpetual,
that's right.
That's really neither here nor there, as I understood it. It's your main argument, which was the statute changes that, says what it says, and assuming it's read the way you read it, which we have to confront, then we have to confront the constitutional question.
That's all correct, Your Honor.
Let me go a little bit to Section 211.
Yes.
Put aside the legislative history and the Bacardi objective.
Yes.
It says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, no transaction or payment shall be authorized.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you go to the general license.
Yes.
It authorized the trademark and the renewal. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
If you read that, shall is a future.
Yes. Okay,
shall be authorized. It doesn't apply to something that's already been authorized. Is that correct?
Yes, but...
And the general license authorized both the license and the renewal.
Yes, that's all true, but it didn't authorize forever into the future renewals forever. In other words, the general license was in place.
It simply said renewal.
Yes.
Did that imply that renewal only up until the time we say you can renew?
Yes, it did, because general licenses like special licenses are authorization from the secretary at his or her discretion and can be revoked or changed or modified at any time.
All right, let me ask you this question.
Yes.
Assuming you read the transaction, this transaction that 211 refers to as the general license, okay, and that a general license says the transaction is authorized, including renewal. Assuming you read that as renewal 2-3 times, then 211 speaks only with respect to new transactions. Isn't that correct?
I don't follow that reading, and part of the reason I don't think you can read 211 that way is that it refers to other things. For example, it says no payment shall be authorized. Well, it is clear, but it hasn't already been authorized. That payment for a new renewal fee has not been authorized.
What language are you referring to?
Again, Section 211A1.
Yes, go ahead.
Notwithstanding any other provision of law, no transaction or payment shall be authorized or approved. And what Your Honor, I believe, is suggesting is that this particular payment at issue in our case had been previously approved.
Exactly.
But that approval was withdrawn by this statute.
Oh, now wait a minute. Okay, so you're saying there's a distinction between the payment and the transaction.
Well,
in other words, the transaction, which is the trademark registration and renewal, is authorized, but not the payment.
No, I'm not saying that at all, because the government views the renewal as a completely different transaction
there,
entirely.
There's simply no question. You'll agree that the original registration Is not
covered by Section 211.
Is not in question.
Yes.
Okay. So you read this as the payment then for renewal.
And the renewal
separate matter.
And the renewal, both are separate, yes. And one of the ways you know that that's true is because there is this payment requirement. It's not automatic.
Let me ask you a straight question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think that's clear language, or do you think it's rather ambiguous, as the Second Circuit said?
No, I think
I mean, if you were really writing this to do what it is alleged that Bacardi or you would write it differently, wouldn't you?
Well,
you'd say, notwithstanding any other provisional law, no transaction, including a renewal of a trademark, shall be authorized.
It's always possible to write things more clearly, Your Honor. Absolutely.
I'm just asking you whether this is, truthfully, whether the Second Circuit is right, this is ambiguous.
Truthfully, I don't see how you can say that a renewal is the same transaction.
Do you think the Second Circuit was wrong to say it's ambiguous?
I'm not sure that the Second Circuit said it was ambiguous in the respect that we're talking about.
I think it did.
All right. Well, to the extent that it did, yes, I do think it was wrong.
Second Circuit was wrong.
I do, and I also...
If the Second Circuit was right...
Okay.
...that the language is ambiguous as
yes.
to whether it applies the way the appellants point out or the way you point out...
Yes.
...isn't there a principle of law, without even getting to the constitutional question, that is stated by Justice Kennedy in Bowen, that retroactive interpretations are disfavored, and unless if it's ambiguous, the court should avoid it?
I believe that the appropriate statement of law to apply in that circumstance is Chevron, which is that if a statute is ambiguous...
No. I'm talking about Bowen. Are you familiar with Bowen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you remember Justice Kennedy's opinion for the court?
Not in the detail that you do, Your Honor.
Well, apparently. But Justice Kennedy, you may recall, said that there's a tradition under the law that a retroactivity is disfavored, and therefore if a statute is ambiguous as to whether it's retroactive or not, a court should reach an interpretation that is not retroactive.
Yes, Your Honor, there are two responses to that. The first is it's not retroactive. It is being applied to a transaction that is occurring after the enactment of the statute. The statute was enacted in 1998. The renewal was sought in 2005. And when you apply a 1998 statute to a transaction that occurs in 2005, it is not retroactive. So that's the first answer.
I don't know how you can make that argument in light of Ewing. If it's a perpetual right, which Ewing says, I'm looking at it right now, it's a very strong statement. And you can't find anything in the statute that's been materially changed. These people had a registration with a right of renewal, which were perpetual.
It was not perpetual, Your Honor.
Well,
and I understand that you're looking at Ewing, but I still maintain that under the statute that was at issue here,
your
it was not perpetual.
Your point is the case is even older than Judge Edwards.
Nothing is.
And moreover, there were other ways in which it's not perpetual.
That's such a distressing argument for us to listen to when you assert that with such vigor, and you have no support whatsoever.
Your Honor, there is case law support as well for the proposition. The In re Holland case, for example, had a renewal that failed because the paperwork was submitted too early. And the court in that case, it's not this court, I believe it's the Second Circuit, said that it didn't matter that whether or not the mark had been abandoned, which is what Cuba Export claims is the only issue, there are requirements for renewal. There have always been requirements for renewal. You have to pay a fee, and you have always had to pay a fee.
You, Holland, or whatever case it is you're talking about,
yes.
It's effective abandonment if you don't come to the office and do what you're supposed to.
You also have to pay a fee. And that's really what's at issue in this case. What's at issue in this case is Cuba Export's inability to pay the fee that is unquestionably a requirement for obtaining a renewal. So you can't say that renewal is automatic, and you can't say it's perpetual when everyone agrees that you have always had and you still have to pay a fee. And under Cuba Export's view of the world, the Congress of the United States could not increase that fee. Because once you have obtained your original registration, you have a perpetual right to obtain renewals forever.
Congress have increased the fee to $500 million?
Yes. Congress. To answer your question, it's obviously an extreme hypothetical, but Congress could decide to no longer allow renewals. And the question...
It could, without affecting property rights for people across the board. Suppose Congress passed a law tomorrow saying everybody who has a trademark can no longer have it be renewed.
Can no longer have it be renewed.
Right.
Yes. That would not pose due process
for everybody problems. In the United States?
For everyone in the United States, yes.
That would not affect a due process question?
Because what the people possess now are fixed-term registrations that expire at fixed times in the future.
They don't expire by their terms. Not if you read Ewing. That there's a difference between what Ewing talks about in terms of perpetual, it being a perpetual right, and those cases, one of which I've written, which talk about licenses that expire by their terms.
Again, the license...
I don't know how you can read Ewing. It's like you're not reading. It's like you really do believe because it's old, it's gone.
No, Your Honor, I don't. I believe that it was involved a different statutory scheme.
Please don't say that again, because you're just not supporting it.
Your Honor, the statute...
It doesn't matter that it involved a different statutory scheme. Your point is that the new statute, right, altered...
Yes. In other words, what governs this court with respect is the statute. And the statute says that what is being granted when a registration is given is a registration for a fixed term.
Let's suppose the statute in place said that they're perpetual. The statute said they're perpetual.
Yes, Your Honor.
30 years later, Congress comes in and says, that's actually a disaster. We're going to change that. They're no longer perpetual. They have to be renewed every 5 years based on circumstances that Congress outlines in the statute or factors. Can Congress do that? Or is Congress prohibited from once making it perpetual ever changing that again by the Constitution?
Congress is not prohibited from changing its mind even when it initially confers.
What about the property rights that Judge Silberman mentioned that would be altered by such a congressional scheme? What's the analysis that you would put forth that would permit Congress to do that?
The statute here is being challenged on substantive due process grounds, and the rules for invalidating a statute on substantive due process are not only that it affect a vested property right and that it do so retroactively, but also that the statute not be a rational means to serve a legitimate legislative purpose. That's the applicable test.
Judge Kavanaugh's question a little further.
Yes.
Doesn't it depend on what Congress's basis for that change is? In other words, I think Judge Kavanaugh is right that Congress could abrogate the perpetuity of a renewal right going forward. But it's a much more serious question whether Congress could do so only for people who engaged in a certain transaction back in 1960.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then you've changed the legal status of a behavior back in 1960. That's primary retroactivity. Now, no court has ever quite held that there's a violation of substantive due process, even though counsel argues substantive due process. Several occurring opinions of the Supreme Court have suggested the possibility. But you'd have a real problem there if the basis for the change going forward was based on behavior back 30 years ago.
I agree with that on the premise that this is a perpetual right, which we obviously disagree with. But yes, there is a difference, and the basis matters, and that goes to the prong of retroactivity.
Right.
And the point that I was trying to make previously is that it is not the case that all retroactive statutes violate due process. It is not at all the case.
You're mixing up primary and secondary retroactivity. I commend to you Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Bowen to explain that at great length, but Justice Kennedy's opinion certainly relies on the proposition that in reading a statute, if it's ambiguous, you should read it against a retroactive application.
There is no retroactive application here because there is no perpetual right. However, to the extent that this is viewed as retroactive, it remains constitutional. And the reading of the statute...
You don't even have to get to the constitutional question under Bowen.
Your point is that you would read...
Justice Kennedy relied on the common law notion. He said you don't read a statute as retroactive if you can avoid it, if it's ambiguous, because under the common law that's disfavored.
It may be disfavored, but I believe that Chevron would require this court in interpreting this statute to defer to OFAC's interpretation.
If you remember, Bowen, the government argued Chevron and Justice Kennedy rejected it.
Nonetheless, I believe that Chevron would apply here. But let me, if I may, finish the point, which is that retroactive legislation is not automatically violative of due process. It only violates due process.
Okay, exactly. Carlton was retroactive tax legislation, which went back and took people's money, and the Ninth Circuit said it violated substantive due process, and the Supreme Court unanimously reversed, Justice Scalia concurring, saying, if anything's unfair, you would think retroactive tax legislation is, but it doesn't violate substantive due process.
That's right. We cited
this
in our
case. This was secondary retroactivity, not primary retroactivity. Isn't that correct?
We cited a number
Isn't
of cases.
Correct, counsel?
In Carlton?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because in Bowen, Justice Scalia makes very clear that when you're dealing with secondary retroactivity, you judge it under the arbitrary and capricious standard of its APA. But primary retroactivity is a much more serious problem.
This is secondary retroactivity, again.
No, I don't think
because so. There is no established property right in the renewal.
Well, that gets back to Judge Edwards' point.
Yeah, that gets back to your argument, which you haven't supported. So does it matter whether you can support it?
Yeah, well, it may matter, but even assuming there's secondary there's primary retroactivity here. We cite a number of cases that do involve primary retroactivity that in the immigration context, where old conduct involving criminal activity was later made the subject of deportability. And so individuals said, wait a minute, you can't pass a law that allows you to deport me based on crimes that I committed before that law was passed. It seems to me that if I'm understanding this correctly,
they have a perpetual right to remain in the United States?
Did they have a perpetual right to? No more than there's a perpetual right
well,
to.
Well, that's the question. They didn't have, so the argument here on the other side is going to be that's different because there's a perpetual right here. In those cases, there was no asserted perpetual right.
It's an instance, I'm trying to give Judge Silberman an instance of primary retroactivity where the courts nonetheless apply the test of rational means to serve a legitimate legislative purpose.
Basically between primary and secondary activity can be stated as follows. When you have retroactivity, in secondary retroactivity, the government takes a situation which parties created under existing law and change the law going forward, i.e., I had a tax advantage to buy an apartment building in 1960. Congress in 2010 changes that tax law so that the advantage I had in 1960 is destroyed. That is secondary retroactivity.
And that is what's present here. And let me give
primary active retroactivity is a situation where Congress says, uh-oh, back in 1960 you did something which we said was legal. We now say it's illegal. And then it's, you have a problem. That is what you've done in this case.
I disagree, Your Honor, and let
you've
me explain.
You've taken facts that took place back in the 50s and saying, we're now going to give a legal significance to that, which we never did before.
That actually is not what's happened here, if I may explain, Your Honor. And that has to do with the interaction between the trademark law at issue here and the Cuban embargo. Because in 1976, the trademark law was not the only law that was applicable to the situation here. The law related to the Cuban embargo also applied. And that law said that as a general matter, all transactions involving Cuban property and Cuban interests were barred. And then it created a number of exceptions. All of the exceptions to that general bar are at the sole discretion of the Secretary of the Treasury or his or her designee. And it has always been the case, or let me rephrase, in 1976, it was the case that whatever trademark right Cuba Export could acquire was acquired subject to the rules of the embargo and therefore required the license of the Secretary of the Treasury. That license was always at the Secretary's discretion, could always be withdrawn at any time. And so that is part of the law that has to be considered when you ask yourselves whether this was in fact a perpetual right or not. The acquisition of this right occurred in 1976, and the law in place told Cuba Export and told the whole world that the ability to obtain and retain this registration right was solely at the discretion of the secretary in giving a license for that activity. And under those circumstances, what Section 211 did, and all Section 211 did, was come in and say that licensing authority as a procedural matter can no longer be exercised in this instance under a general license, but must be exercised under a specific license. But it's the same discretionary licensing authority that the secretary has that this trademark right has always been subject to. So even if it is true as a general matter of trademark law that you had this concept of perpetuality, that was changed with respect to the unique context that we are now, the Cuban assets. That was changed prior to 1976. That was changed at least as far back as 1963 when the embargo went into effect. So even if it's true generally that trademarks are perpetual, which we disagree with, and even if Ewing is correct and still valid, Ewing does not apply to the Cuban embargo world. And when we're talking about retroactivity, there's no retroactivity.
Wait a minute. It doesn't apply to the Cuban embargo world for what reason?
Well, because to the extent that it applies, that perpetuality was altered by Congress not in 1998 with the enactment of Section 211, but rather in 1963.
I'm not sure I understand. How did they alter it in 1963?
In 1963, the embargo came in and attached different conditions to transactions relating to trademarks.
The embargo only relates to doing business here. How does it relate to, and the appellants have conceded they can't do business until the embargo lifts. That's got nothing to do with the value or the trademark. That's why I'm puzzled.
Well, it does have something to do with the value of the trademark, but...
No, the status of the trademark, you're right.
But the answer is that the rules of the embargo, again, there are general prohibitions in the embargo that are extremely broad. And any transaction that falls within those broad prohibitions is barred unless it is... subject of a license by the secretary.
Yeah, but that's the whole question. There is a license here. There's a general license.
Mystified. There was a general license, but my point is...
Are you saying OFAC can say, we issued a general license under which the appellant operated, but we're going to now pass a regulation saying that was null and void. We were wrong.
Well, it may be that there is that authority, but that's not what I'm claiming at the moment. What I'm claiming is that general license can be withdrawn at will by the secretary. And that means several things, one of which is that there is no, as this court held in Burger Co., there is no property interest.
You relied on 211, did you not? You being the government.
Relied on 211.
Yes.
Yes.
You didn't rely on any general authority other than 211.
Well, 211 is a piece of, no, that's not correct, because 211 only has impact on a general license that is part of the overall scheme. So you have to start with the premise that the general scheme prohibits these activities. The general license originally allowed them.
I read the documents that OFAC issued.
Yes.
They relied on 211.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor.
Okay, and if they relied on 211 and they misread 211, then they lose, right? You're saying they might have had other authority to rely on which they didn't rely on.
I believe,
that's a different case.
I believe that if you believed that the reasoning applied by OFAC was invalid because of a misreading of the statute, you would need to remand to the agency to do it. But with respect...
To do what?
To reevaluate the specific license application in light of a correct reading of the statute 211.
Well, if we concluded 211 didn't apply... I don't quite understand. Well, I think I understand what you're driving at. You want another. If we're right, if this dialogue, if appellants are right, you want another shot.
Well, Your Honor, the decision maker should be OFAC. That's the way the statute is written.
Okay.
I know I'm way over my time, but we haven't discussed at all the procedural due process issues that were discussed earlier, and I would like a chance. to
What about my question to counsel concerning what process, what factual, the Supreme Court has held in a cases of Carlton that when you make a claim for due process, you have to have a factual issue that you wish to litigate.
We don't believe that there is one here, but again, we, like you, are dependent upon Cuba Export's answer to those questions, because Cuba Export has, you know, sort of intentionally and obviously withheld and avoided giving OFAC any of the documentation that would support its arguments about the general license and any of its any evidence whatsoever. And frankly, the notion that it never had the opportunity to do so doesn't make any sense to us for a variety of reasons. And I'd like to address first the most obvious of that, which is that we believe that Cuba Export had noticed that the general license was going to be at issue here from day one. And there's a very important point that hasn't been discussed
yet. What's day one, April 7th, 06?
December 13th, 05.
December 13th, 05, okay.
And the reason
the time they applied to renew, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason for that is a very important part of the regulations that hasn't been discussed yet, which is, excuse me, 31, well, sorry, there are two issues. The first issue is the rules regarding the relationship between general licenses and specific licenses. The general license, the OFAC has a rule that it will not issue a specific license for any activity that is covered by the general a general license. That is in OFAC's internal procedures. That's 31 CFR 501.801A. Now, counsel who were involved in this case are familiar with OFAC regulations and understood this. And what that means is from December 13, 2005, when Cuba Export attempted to renew its registration, when it proffered the fee, it told USPTO and OFAC that it was proffering the fee under a specific license. It has abandoned that argument that the specific license for litigation allowed it to pay the renewal fee. But the point is that it said, we are doing this under a specific license.
Well, I thought your point, too, was at least from April 6, 06, they were certainly on notice to put forth all arguments.
They were on notice to put forth all arguments.
Support of a license.
Yes. By asking for a specific license, they were conceding that there was no general license, because under the OFAC's regulations, it doesn't make sense. It would be futile to ask for a specific license when a general license applies. And then, as Your Honor noted, on June 14th, they specifically made the argument to USPTO, copied to OFAC, asking USPTO to consider the general license. It said the PTO may not refuse to renew the Havana Club registration unless it interprets the general license and decides that it prohibits renewal. So to say that this thing, that the discussion of the general license dropped out of the blue on July 28th seems disingenuous at best, when Cuba Export itself was asking previously that it be decided in its submissions to USPTO. Now, even if that were not true, and even if July 28, 2006 is the notice date, there's another very important regulation, which is 31 CFR 501.801B4. It's in part of the regulations dealing with specific licenses, and it's entitled Effect of Denial, which is what happened on July 28th. The denial of a license does not preclude the reopening of an application or the filing of a further application. The applicant or any other party in interest may at any time request explanation of the reasons for a denial by correspondence or personal interview. And just now before Your Honors, Cuba Export's counsel said, well, once we got that denial, we had to run to court. That's just not true. There were procedures that would have allowed Cuba Export to obtain all the relief.
They made a point about it would be hard because the day before the relevant facts had changed. But in any event, you stand on your broader argument that they were on notice for several months beforehand.
Both of those things, but I want to emphasize that even after that date, whatever relief this court could afford is the same relief that they could have obtained at the administrative level. They could have obtained a reversal of the denial of their specific license, which is all that they're really asking for from this court.
I think we have your argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor. First of all, we would not ask that the court send us back to OFAC for more determination.
I'm sorry. Can I ask you one question out of the box, which is where did you argue in this case that the 211, as read by OFAC, was inconsistent with the text of 211?
Your Honor, I'll have to go back in our briefs down below to see where that.
No, I meant here.
Here in our briefs in this case.
I thought your arguments were that 211 was unconstitutional as read by OFAC.
If, as read by OFAC, it's unconstitutional, but the presumption against retroactivity should apply. You shouldn't read it. Thank you, Carl. So in our opening brief, Your Honor, on page 36, mm-hmm. we argue that we could avoid these constitutional issues altogether. And the substantive due process issues by construing Section 211 as prospective, which mm-hmm. is the point I was making in my opening argument. Mm-hmm.
And you did point out the Second Circuit had regarded that as ambiguous. I read that in your brief somewhere.
Exactly, Your Honor. We talked about the Havana Club case in our opening brief, actually throughout. There's quite a few page references, but including in that section on page 37 of our opening brief, we note the Second Circuit's decision that Section 211 does not clearly indicate that it should be applied retroactively. And indeed, if the court interprets...
You can go back to your what you were planning.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, but on this point, if the court interprets, as we believe it should, Section 211 is only being prospective, what that means, to answer Judge Edwards' question before, is that it wouldn't apply to the Havana Club registration. It would apply to new registrations in the future. But Section 211 would not apply to the Havana Club registration, and therefore, when we go to renew next time, we don't have to worry about Section 211 applying, because Section 211 will never apply to the Havana Club registration. It wouldn't apply to existing registrations prior to 1990.
It'll be pointless.
Exactly. It would be pointless for us to have to do that again.
No.
The statute would be pointless.
No, the statute is not, Your Honor. If tomorrow...
I realize there could be future...
I'll give you an example. The Arachabella family, in addition to using the trademark Havana Club, had a logo. And it has a tree in it, in a circle. We don't use that logo. But if tomorrow Cuba Export said, you know, we liked that old tree logo, we're going to come and apply for registration in the United States for that tree logo, Section 211, read prospectively, would bar that, because that was a trademark used in association with their confiscated distillery, if, by the way, their distillery was confiscated for the purpose of this argument. Section 211 has relevant application, because it says we're not going to allow any new registrations, but our old registration from 1976, it is perpetual for the reasons Judge Edwards has now come to love in the Ewing case, and as I mentioned, the In re Bose case.
Don't overstay. Yeah.
Don't say. Judge Edwards loves his old cases.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't overstay.
Even in Bose last year, the Federal Circuit, talking about renewal, says that the purpose of renewal is to knock Deadwood off of the registry, but the public interest
is Congress. Suppose my hypothetical, Congress has a statute and says they're perpetual, and then 30 years later, the Congress says, wait a second, that's creating all sorts of problems, and we're going to change that. No longer are they perpetual. Unconstitutional?
If it
can't
take,
do it, Congress says to till the end of time,
if it takes
perpetual.
Away property rights,
mm-hmm.
it's
substantive due process.
Substantive due process, and then we do get to the government's argument, was there nevertheless a rational basis for that retroactive application? So you still would have that discussion, why did Congress do it, which there's some basis for
Isn't
the
your
retroactivity.
Answer, it depends on why Congress cuts off the renewal.
Exactly. We'd have to see
I think Judge Kavanaugh is absolutely correct. Congress can cut off the renewal and so long as it doesn't base its grounds for cutting off renewal an illegality or a treatment of a transaction 60 years ago or 50 years ago in a new way.
Because it attaches new consequences
right.
to those old rights, primary retroactivity. Your Honor, thank you very much.
Didn't the legal landscape change in 63 as the government argued with the embargo? And so whatever you thought, whatever anyone thought they had, was substantially different from that point forward?
Well, with the Cuban asset control regulations put in place a mechanism to freeze and preserve Cuban assets, not to destroy Cuban assets. In fact, destroying Cuban assets is not consistent with the goals of what the government wanted to accomplish with the embargo. The point was to freeze and preserve those assets. And this application of Section 211, if it were applied to our mark, would not preserve this asset for possible use in the future. Rather, it would destroy the asset. So the 1963 Act, the Cuban Asset Control Regulations, did not change our view with respect to whether or not this was a trademark right that we acquired in 1976, by the way, 13 years after the CACR, which came with it this right to perpetual renewal, as long as you affirm your mark has not been abandoned. And that's why I don't believe there's any relevance to this argument that even when we applied for our mark in 76, our right to renew was subject to the Secretary deciding just to take it away at any time. If there was a license to allow the Cubans to buy some property, to acquire a property interest, and that was permitted, it would be perverse if years later they said, oh, we're not going to allow you to pay your property tax, and that will result in the forfeiture of your property. That's exactly what's happening here. Our property, it exists. We have it. But we're being disallowed to preserve it because we're not being allowed to pay a $400
fee. I don't know where you're – I'm not sure what your analogy really works, because if you had a trademark which allowed you to do business and make money, and then the government says you can't do business, you can't make any money, all you have is a piece of paper, that would fit what you just described.
That would go to the
and
question.
You're not suggesting that there's anything wrong with that. That is making the trademark valueless in the United States.
The trademark still has value if it's preserved. You know, we can't,
it
we get nothing. We would, both sides would not have been expending the efforts they had on this case.
I just don't understand your last example, because the government clearly has made that much less valuable than it was if you can't do business.
But at least under the CACR, the whole rational purpose of the CSCR is to preserve these assets, not to destroy them. And that's the effect of 211 being applied in its primary retroactive way.
These are all contingent. They have certain value, but the nature of the value is contingent on the end of the embargo.
That's correct, at which point presumably the United States will have made the decision that it's appropriate for these assets to be exploited again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is submitted.